This is New Testament Theology, cassette number 3, side B. We've been talking about the theme of fulfillment in relation to the Christology of Matthew's Gospel, and in particular, this theme in relation to the law, Jesus and the law. We've mentioned the extremes, the polar extremes in the Gospel of Matthew, the antinomian extreme suggested by hints at Matthew chapter 5, verse 17, Matthew 7, verse 23, and Matthew 24, verse 12. There are several other places as well. The legalistic extreme suggested at places like chapter 5, verse 20, and in Jesus' numerous encounters with the religious authorities, various controversies with them over Sabbath observance and other legal observance. Matthew chapter 12 and other locations. Matthew seems to try to bring about a resolution to this whole question of the law and human tendency to go to one extreme or another, and says in his presentation of Christ by way of the theme of fulfillment that the law now finds its center in Christ, who declares with authority, an authority quite unlike that of the scribes. Jesus' authority is not a derivative authority. He does not base his opinions and declarations about the law and law observance upon the teaching of previous generations of rabbis, but he simply declares this is so and has a unique authority in the context of the day relative to the authority that the rabbis possessed. And Jesus declares in the Sermon on the Mount, "Think not that I have come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." And it's by way of Jesus' person and ministry, the person and work of Christ, that the law ultimately is fulfilled, and some of these tensions are resolved. Jesus, during his ministry, cuts to the heart of the law and pushes beyond always literal outward conformity to the law, to deal with deeper underlying principles at stake in the law, the intentions of the human heart, and these kinds of issues. So Jesus is never anti-law. He tries to push the law toward its true intent and purpose. And ultimately, the true intent and purpose of the law comes to light in the unfolding of the ministry of Jesus. And in that ministry, Jesus emphasizes the preeminence of the love command. Chapter 5, 43-47 in the Sermon on the Mount. Chapter 7, verse 12, the so-called golden rule. Really and truly another way of talking about the love command. And chapter 22, 35-40, where he declares that on the twofold love command, perfect total love for God and self-denying love for neighbor, upon these two commands, Jesus declares, depend all the law and the prophets. Again, that declaration and everything else we could say about the law in the Gospel of Matthew cannot be detached from the context of a story that ultimately ends in the death and the resurrection of Jesus. This is how Matthew ultimately addresses the polar extremes of legalism on the one hand and antinomianism on the other hand. It's the power of the crucifixion and the resurrection which provides the key to understanding what it means that Jesus is the fulfillment of the law. Jesus is the perfect embodiment of what it is to be faithful to the law, especially the law as summarized in the twofold love command. Through his life, ministry, suffering, death, and resurrection from the dead, we see exemplified in perfect form obedience to the love command, total love for God, and love for neighbor as oneself. And through the unfolding of Jesus' ministry, the power is unleashed for us, for human beings, to fulfill the law, to walk by the Spirit, to use the language of Paul. But you can see where all lines converge, whether we're talking about themes, Christological titles, events in the ministry of Jesus, all lines converge in the cross. Everything makes sense in the light of the cross. Now, there are numerous other themes that we could talk about in the Gospel of Matthew close to the heart of this gospel's theological idiom, the theme of the kingdom of heaven. Matthew definitely prefers the expression kingdom of heaven over the expression kingdom of God. the theme of Galilee and the emphasis upon the ministry in Galilee as opposed to Jerusalem seems that it's more pronounced in the Gospel of Matthew. Jerusalem is presented as the place of opposition to Jesus, and there are all kinds of subtle nuances associated with some of these themes as they come to the fore in the Gospel of Matthew. One that we perhaps should make mention of is associated with the genealogy of Christ, which is a unique feature of this gospel. Jesus' genealogy is presented in three groups of 14 each in the first chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. And there are certain irregularities associated with this genealogy that ought not surprise us when we consider the Christological presentation of the gospel as a whole. Figures like Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba, people of Gentile background, and also some sexual irregularities associated with their lives, outsiders to Israel, sexually suspect, or perhaps we should say legally suspect as concerns the Old Testament law. But God works through these folks in a surprising way, ultimately to bring redemption to Israel and to the nations. And the genealogy with its irregularities prepares us all the more for the surprising birth of Jesus by the Virgin Mary and the surprising ministry of Jesus to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and to so-called nobodies in Israel, a humble ministry, a ministry which is consistent with the inherently paradoxical nature of the cross, the ultimate outcome of that ministry. As we now continue to explore the theological idiom, distinctive theological idiom of the Gospel of Matthew, let's turn to the related subject of discipleship. Matthew has a unique presentation of the subject of discipleship, what it means to be a follower of Jesus, or to consider becoming a follower of Jesus. It ought to be pointed out at the outset that the Gospel of Matthew uniquely uses the word for church, the Greek word ekklesia, in a kind of foreshadowing way. The word occurs in the 16th chapter of Matthew, surrounding the confession by Peter of Jesus as the Christ, the Son of the living God. And there Jesus speaks of the foundation upon which he will build his church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And later, in the 18th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus refers to the church in the context of instructions related to church discipline. So we have some unique reference to the church as a community of God's people gathered in the name of Christ, unified by a common commitment to the person of Christ and to the doing of what he has commanded through his life and ministry. So there is some explicit reference to the church and what it means to be a part of that community, the community of followers of Jesus. Now we also get insights into this whole matter of discipleship by way of conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders, especially the Pharisees in the Gospel of Matthew. They preserve for us a kind of foil to what discipleship is or what it ought to be. By way of an opposite extreme, we gain insight into discipleship. By way of their legalistic extremes, we are brought to develop keener insights into what it means to be a disciple of Jesus through this conflict. This conflict is a kind of driving force in the unfolding of the story of Jesus and the narrative of the Gospel of Matthew. It comes early on when the Pharisees plot to destroy Jesus, and that plotting ultimately is fulfilled in their role in the engineering of Jesus' condemnation before the religious authorities and before the Roman authorities toward the end of the Gospel of Matthew, prior to Jesus' crucifixion and the resurrection. So there's a rich fund of resources in those conflicts for seeing what discipleship is all about by way of a foil with the Pharisees and them in particular as they are engaged in conflict with Jesus, as they stand in opposition to Jesus. Peter is presented uniquely as a kind of representative disciple in the Gospel of Matthew, so a study of the life of Peter gives insights into the meaning of discipleship. Peter is a person of extremes, as are most many human beings. Many of us can identify with Peter in his tremendously courageous, eloquent confession of who Jesus was at Caesarea Philippi, and then in the next minute he is resisting Jesus' true identity as one who ultimately will go to the cross. And then, of course, we are reminded of the denial of Jesus by Peter, as recorded, of course, not just in the Gospel of Matthew, but in other Gospels as well. And finally, we can highlight some of the distinctives of discipleship in the Gospel of Matthew, distinctives which tend to hold true for the other Gospels as well. there are definite distinctives to what it meant and means to be a disciple as compared to what was characteristic of disciples of rabbis in the time of Jesus. Normally, the learner at the feet of a rabbi chose his own teacher. Paul and Gamaliel, this was likely a relationship chosen by Paul or by people who assisted Paul in making the choice, and then the learner would go and put himself at the feet of the teacher. But in the Gospel of Matthew, we see that the disciple becomes a disciple in response to Jesus' prior call. That takes priority. And there is the expectation of nothing but obedient response, a call to God's reign in the life of the disciple through the call of Jesus. Second, with the rabbis, the Torah stood at the center in their relationship with their disciples, whereas in the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus stands at the center, the person of Jesus. Jesus replaces the Torah, in essence, as the center. Wherever two or three are gathered in my name, there am I in the midst. Third, discipleship for the rabbis was a means to an end, or for the student of the rabbi was a means to an end. The goal ultimately was to become a rabbi. Whereas discipleship in the Gospel of Matthew is not a first step toward a promising career or some transitional stage onto something higher, but discipleship in itself is the fulfillment of one's destiny in the Gospel of Matthew. There's an inherent value to discipleship in itself, and that in itself, just to be a disciple. The disciple doesn't graduate into a rabbi. Four, disciples of the rabbis tended only to be students of the rabbi and not a whole lot more. There might have been exceptions to this, of course. Whereas Jesus' disciples are also his servants, and the disciples obey Jesus. He is their Lord, their master. But ironically, the master or Lord is also a servant to the disciples. Fifth, the disciples of the rabbis were entrusted with passing on the teachings of the rabbi and previous generations of rabbis to the next generation. They were charged with being faithful custodians of the insights and debates and decisions of the rabbis. Jesus' disciples, on the other hand, were called simply to be with him. They were also called to share in his mission, and they were enlisted in the service of God's reign. They were called first and foremost not to be faithful custodians of insights, but to be witnesses ultimately to his death and resurrection and to his life and ministry insofar as it is a part of this larger picture shaped by the death and the resurrection of Christ. And then sixth and finally, schools of the rabbis tended to develop into exclusive gatherings. You had the school of Hillel, the school of Shammai, which was well established by the time of Jesus. The disciples of Jesus, however, were called not to be an exclusive group of super followers, but they were members of a community just like everyone else. There was a provisional nature to their discipleship. They were people of the end time. And they were called to be on guard, to watch, and to be faithful They were not to develop into exclusive gatherings. As a matter of fact, quite the opposite. They were called to minister always and ever outside and beyond themselves and their own groups and circles. For these insights on discipleship in the Gospel of Matthew, I'm heavily indebted to the missiologist David Bosch's work entitled Transforming Mission, published by Orbis. Now, having reviewed something of the theological nature of the Gospel of Matthew, we turn next to the Gospel of Mark, and rather than reinvent the wheel, so to speak, we try to highlight some of the distinctive features of this Gospel in ways that do not unnecessarily repeat some of the things we've already affirmed in our treatment of the Gospel of Matthew. We begin by considering the place of this Gospel in the New Testament canon. It comes second in the structure of our canon, sandwiched between the longer Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Approximately 90% of the Gospel of Mark can be found in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. The Gospel of Mark is our shortest Gospel, shortest of the Gospels. The belief in the priority of the Gospel of Mark, chronologically, that it was written first, is a relative latecomer on the scene of church history. Early on in the church, as we've already noted, there was a belief that the Gospel of Matthew was written first, and it's been within the past 200 years or so that the theory of the Gospel of the historical priority of the Gospel of Mark has dominated the scene of biblical scholarship, especially. Let's look at some issues of overall theological structure and style in the Gospel of Mark. We note at the beginning of this Gospel the unique use of the term Gospel. In the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1, verse 1, we read, "The beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." George Eldon Ladd, in his Theology of the New Testament, says the following: "It is generally agreed that the use of the term Gospel to describe a genre of literature derives from its use in Mark 1:1. Whether or not Mark himself so intended it, this is no mere historical record, but good news, and the good news is Jesus. The very first verse, therefore, alerts us to expect a theological, indeed evangelistic, presentation of the life and teaching of Jesus." That's found on page 229. Johnson, in his introduction entitled The Writings of the New Testament, says the following: "In these opening verses, Mark's readers encounter not the story of every man, but that of God's unique Son, who spins history on its axis and calls for conversion, a change of heart and mind. In the story of this man, the mystery of God is at work." Page 159. The Gospel of Mark is a much faster moving narrative. There's relatively less discourse. However, there are some significantly large blocks of discourse in Mark relative to the size of that Gospel. We see the pervasive use of the adverb immediately or straightway. Immediately Jesus did this, straightway he did this, only emphasizing the fast pace of the narrative that much more. Some dramatic features are more pronounced due to the compact, fast-paced narrative that we find in this Gospel. As far as Jesus' activity and movement are concerned, it seems it comes off as more rapid and fast-paced. The theme of Jesus suppressing his identity seems to be accented more because of relatively shorter length of the Gospel. This theme seems to come more to the fore. There are some vexing problems when you look at the overall structure of the Gospel. One especially is the controversy of the so-called shorter and longer endings of the Gospel, a particularly difficult textual problem, which puts before us the question of whether the Gospel should end at chapter 15, verse 7, I think, chapter 16, verse 8, or whether it should end with some version of what we find in chapters, in verses 9 through 20 of some of the Greek manuscripts. Many scholars today believe the gospel originally ended abruptly with the eighth verse. It is a difficult and controversial text-critical problem. But in Morris's book, New Testament Theology, he quotes Stonehouse, and Stonehouse says the following, Ned B. Stonehouse, or he refers to Stonehouse, Ned B. Stonehouse points out that the opening of this gospel is abrupt, and we've already noticed that. There is no genealogy, no extended opening, easing us into the life and ministry of Jesus, as is the case with Matthew and Luke. It's abrupt, and Stonehouse reasons that we should not be surprised at something similar in the ending. If Mark can be satisfied to narrate so little concerning the beginning of the life of Jesus, there is nothing to compel him to treat the conclusion at length. Now, as far as the overall structure of the gospel is concerned, there tends to be universal agreement about this gospel. Maybe not in the particulars, but there is a broad universal agreement that the gospel roughly falls into two halves, and that somewhere about around the eighth chapter, toward the end of the eighth chapter, where Peter confesses Jesus to be the Christ, that this is a pivotal turning point. Peter's confession and what that reveals about the nature of discipleship, much of which overlaps with the record we have in the other Gospels as well. There is a kind of rapid movement toward the cross from here onward. And again, we recall Kaler's statement that the Gospel of Mark is a passion narrative with an extended introduction. Mark's narrative account of the person and work of Jesus is relatively short and fast-paced, ending as abruptly as it began. Jesus is on the move to carry out his mission, the ultimate fulfillment of which comes at the cross. Mark, in his own distinctive way, using a compact, fast-paced narrative, drives home all the more forcefully the significance of the cross to the person and work of Jesus. His identity and work are truly revealed in the cross. His identity as Son of God and his mission as Savior are all heavily influenced by the cross. Now we can turn and take up a few highlights as to the distinctive theological idiom of this gospel. First, we can look at Christology. Much of what has already been said about Matthew can be said here as well, as far as titles, themes, activity, and so forth are concerned. They are all associated with Jesus, the central figure. But there are some unique features that we can point out about the Gospel of Mark. We've already noted that the title teacher takes prominence in this gospel over the title Lord. This gospel is big on teaching, even though it may not have some of the large blocks of discourse characteristic of the Gospel of Matthew. Teaching is nonetheless significant, and in the way Jesus' ministry plays out, there is a definitely holistic view of Jesus' teaching. It's not just the words that he speaks, but the deeds that he does, which constitute teaching according to this gospel's understanding of Jesus as teacher. We noticed early on in the Gospel of Mark that people are amazed at Jesus' teaching. There's a man with an unclean spirit, in a synagogue in Capernaum, and he cries out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Mark 1:24. Jesus rebukes him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching. With authority he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." So you see a kind of joining of teaching as activity and discourse as well. The very deeds of Jesus constitute teaching, according to the Gospel of Matthew. And we could say similar things to what we've said about other titles in Matthew's presentation, the title Son of God and the Son of Man. Again, all the titles are heavily influenced by the dramatic effect achieved by this compact, fast-paced narrative, which moves rather quickly to the cross, especially following the turning point found in chapters 8 and 9. Jesus' true identity, as all of these, ultimately is revealed in light of the cross. Once again, we note the significance of where the first public confession of Jesus as Son of God comes. It comes after the cross, after the crucifixion, and from the centurion again. Mark only heightens this all the more with his use of the perfect tense form in chapter 16, verse 6, related to anticipation of Jesus. Or we should say an anticipation of an encounter with the resurrected Jesus. At any rate, the young man whom the women encounter at the tomb says to them, "Do not be amazed, you seek Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified." And the point here is that the verb form used for "was crucified" is a perfect tense form of the verb. And this perfect tense form emphasizes the ongoing significance of a past act. So what is being said here is not just that Jesus was crucified, the giving of a bit of information about the past, but something about who he is or the ongoing implications of that past act into the present and beyond. Jesus is affirmed to be both the risen and the crucified Lord. This is consistent with Paul's use of a verb form as well in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 23, chapter 2, verse 2, and you might take a look at some similar uses of perfect tense verb forms in Revelation 13, verse 8, all accenting the ongoing significance of the fact that Jesus was crucified. He is the crucified Lord. And Jack Kingsbury, in his book, The Christology of Mark's Gospel, page 134, comments on the perfect tense. Theologically, the truth Mark underscores by having the risen Jesus designated as the crucified one is that the resurrection does not undo the crucifixion, but on the contrary, confirms the fact of Jesus' death on the cross, confirms the fact that Jesus' death on the cross is the decisive event of his ministry. And so again, we see that in any kind of Christological appreciation of the Gospel of Mark, we must recognize the centrality of the cross and how the entire story has been shaped by the passion narrative. Mark takes great care to establish the person and work of Christ within a mission, the ultimate outcome of which is suffering and death, accented all the more by the abrupt ending of this gospel if we go with the shorter ending. Again, as was the case with the Gospel of Matthew, Christology of the Gospel of Mark, whether we look at it by way of titles, activities, themes, whatever, that Christology is heavily influenced by the cross, by the outcome of the story. This likewise is the case with discipleship. Discipleship is cruciform, shaped by the cross. In many ways, discipleship in Mark is a reflection of the Christology, likewise falling under the influence of the cross. The disciple must walk in the way of the cross and self-sacrifice, liberated from a world dominated by self-seeking and competition, survival of the fittest, liberated to serve in a divine realm where the rule is, many who are first will be last and the last first, chapter 10, verse 31. What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? To take up the cross and follow, to be willing to lose one's life, 8, 34 and 35, to be last of all and servant of all, 9, 35, to allow others to perform wonders with no personal gain for oneself, 9:39. To be initiated into the death of Jesus, to be spent as slave of all, baptized into his death, a unique expression in the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 39 to 44. To walk in the way that Jesus is walking, to follow in his path, to go after him. This is the end of cassette number 3, New Testament Theology.